Well then, here we are again on the, as you just christened it this very moment, Who Let Us Do a Podcast, or the Chaos Pod, or the Madness of the Trans Life Pod, or whatever we want to call it. But hey, Eva, how are you
William,
doing?
I would like to say I'm doing great, but I'm really not. So, just I think the only way I can sum it up is surviving. And I think that's for most people, really. How are you doing?
Yeah, surviving is the go-to word. It's rubbish at the moment. It's been a really rubbish few weeks, with all the other stuff going on in our world and, post Supreme Court, the knee-jerk misinterpretations, the completely indecent haste at which some people have rushed to expose their own transphobia. Yeah, it's been grim. It's been grim.
Grimson, that's another good word to use.
Yeah, but we're here to talk about Idahoblib, and there is a connection, absolutely a connection between grimness and everything else that's going on. So Idahoblib is the International Day Against Homophobia, Transphobia, lesbophobia, interphobia, and biphobia. So, effectively, anyone who is queer facing into hatred, facing into violence, facing into abuse, all of those things are the aim of Idahoblib is really to address that and push us away from from accepting it and allowing it to become part of our lexicon. So, I don't know about you. I've done a few Idahoblib sort of podcasts and talks and things. And I've always been sort of talking about the history of Idahoblib and, it's a UN backed and it's something that we do every year. But I think this year I don't really want to talk about the history of it. I don't want to talk about the semantics of it. I want to talk about our experiences. I've certainly been the subject of hate crime, both online and in person, sadly, with some of those being physical attacks. I would ask you, have you, but I know you have. I know that you've been subject to those things. For those people who've never faced into that, what does it feel like?
It's one of the worst feelings in the world because we're looking over our shoulder every day whenever we leave the house anyway. Now we've got this added layer of fear. And I know that that's what they want us to feel, but I want people to know that that fear takes over. Like a couple of years ago, a certain, I use the term newspaper loosely, wrote a hit piece about me, which resulted in a lot of online hate threats, death threats. And when I was then going out, I was always constantly cautious of where I go. I would only move on like through places where I knew there'd be CCTV. I could call for help if I needed to. But it really does take over. It literally ruins your day because you're so focused on what could happen that you can't focus on just living. And fortunately, nothing happened, nothing came of it. But imagine the people like yourself who have felt, who have felt that, but also felt the physical end of the violence as well, who've been subjected to it. And, those that have then followed through with threats that we normally get online that people laugh off. It's painful. It's something that cishet people will probably never really have to go through, facing hate just for being who you are. Like, yeah, I'm sure that some people will hate cishet people for liking, I don't know, pineapple on pizza, but that's, that's not your identity. That's not your core. This is, we're talking about the very basics of a person, who we are. And to have someone feel so strongly about you that they will take action should make all allies sit up and think, how have we come to this?
Yeah, and I hope a few will. I mean, you raise a great point about the fear of something happening, not just the actuality of it, and hypervigilance is absolutely something I'm living with, and I think a lot of people in our community live with, which is that state of always looking around. You're always wondering where the threat's going to come from, where you're going to be safe, how you move in spaces. You know, can I take a long road trip and also keep hydrated, or do I have to compromise? Do I have to dehydrate myself so I don't need the loo? I don't have to put myself in danger. These are all ridiculous things that, you know, when you talk about them with people who don't think about these, they're shocked and they can't believe it. But one of the incidents for me was at a fuel station on the M3 service station. I was pinned up against a wall by a man after going for a wee. I popped in to have a wee. So it is something I now then think about. You know, how do I avoid having to do that? How do I not go to places where, you know, I have to go to the loo? And, you know, sadly, you know, sometimes you just have to go. When you need to go, you need to go. So I think, you know, in practical terms, the times where I've been assaulted, and like you, I've been the subject of, as I say, I loosely refer to them as newspaper interest, which is not fun on more than one occasion. And yeah, I stopped counting the death and rape threats online at sort of 400. I think that's where I just thought, you know, there's enough's enough. But when it happens in person, and I'm talking as somebody who, you know, early in my career, you know, I learned how to look after myself, you know, in sort of a physical way. I served in the armed forces. It's a completely different environment. When it happens to you, it happens very quickly. Things tend to escalate very suddenly. And that's a common theme across all forms of anti-queer violence. So when we look at some of the evidence of other people as well, they say just literally either there was something which felt like harmless ribbing or something that could be laughed off, and then it turned very quickly to violence, or the violence came from nowhere. And that's certainly my experience. You know, I was kicked to the floor on Brighton seafront after Pride by a group of straight lads coming down for a drink up and a, you know, a queer bashing, and that came completely out of the blue. I mean, I was just basically my legs chopped out from under me from behind, and you're not in a situation to fight back, and in the aftermath you're certainly in a sense of shock, of shame in some ways, you know, embarrassment. You just want to get away, and I think that also accounts for why we know that so many hate crimes aren't reported to the police. And I think there are a number of reasons for that. I think, you know, I think both you and I have worked with the police.
Yeah.
Historically, certainly that's something which has now ceased for me. Not all because I wanted it to, but because there is a pullback from the police in doing what I think is the right thing. But we know that actually sometimes the police don't take it seriously. Sometimes the police will reverse things on you as the victim. And we see that with across a number of demographics, including with women who report sexual offences.
Yeah.
Very similar things. What were you doing? How were you dressed? How were you behaving? What did you expect when you were there? You know, that sort of response. But for me, it's the suddenness. It's the shame. It's the need to flee. You know, say fight or flight. My fight reaction isn't working when I'm out and about nowadays. It is my flight reaction, and living with that is really, really hard. And I think, you know, I made a comment the other day, you know, where I sort of lamented the fact that, you know, I'm navigating the world as a woman, as a trans woman, having seen how men behave when they didn't think women could hear them or there were any women in the room, you know. So for all those years, you know, I know what the underlying element is. And now I'm facing into misogyny, I'm facing into transphobia, I'm facing into homophobia. And I'm having people tell me that the transphobia isn't real and doesn't exist and there's no such thing. And I'm telling people that I'm not eligible to be a victim of misogyny or misogynistic hate crime because I'm not a woman. And you know, the reality of that is the perpetrator sees me as such. The perpetrator sees me as trans. They see me as a woman. They see me as queer. And I think, you know, I don't want to be defined by hatred. But I think when we're thinking about hate crime, when we're thinking about Idahoblit, I think that's a pretty useful yardstick, is who are the people who are receiving the blows and who are giving the blows.
Yeah,
and before we kicked off, you know, we were talking about the erasure of some parts. And you know, I've talked about transphobia being something which, you know, those who hate trans people would say isn't real and doesn't exist. Mm. But you picked up lesbophobia as a very real thing, but it's something which, again, isn't seen as quite the same, or why do we have to separate it? You know, where was your head when you're sort of picking that one up? You know, where are you coming from there?
I think for me, it's important to recognise that every part of the LGBTQ plus community is individual. You know, just because, you know, there are gay men, there are gay women. Yeah, absolutely. But their experiences are not completely the same. The same sex attraction, absolutely. You know, the fear, you know, some of the comments are, you know, not gendered, let's say. But when it comes to lesbians, when we have to take a step back, women have always been objectified. Lesbians are objectified even more. A few years ago, there was the incident of two women on top of a bus who were violently beaten up because they were refusing to kiss on demand for a group of lads. Now, if that were gay men, would it have been, you know, would they have gone down the route of you need to kiss first, let's see you kiss, you know, give us a snog? Absolutely not. They would have skipped that stage and gone straight to the beating. So that shows that when we look at gay men and gay women, men, cis men, see them in a very different light. Mm-hmm. And we have to acknowledge the very unique experiences faced by lesbians on top of the standard homophobia. Mm-hmm. And we live in a world now where misogyny is becoming extreme. It's some of the views that I've seen on social media that go unchallenged, that's classed as banter, and other men comment and support it and take it to extremes. We're seeing that, and that's not going to go away anytime soon. So it's even more important we recognize the individual experiences, because it's bad enough being a woman, it's dangerous enough being a woman, but when you've got, you know, your sexuality on top of that, it's far worse. And for us as trans lesbians, we've then got the element of not just being lesbian but being trans on top of that, so we have even more risk. And you're absolutely right, it's perception. You know, they will attack us if they perceive us to be trans, if they perceive us to be women. Over the last few days, it's been really hot. When I've been going out, I've not been wearing my usual hoodie and sweatpants. And the looks that I get from men, like yesterday, we went out, I had to go, return some clothes. And I was just wearing like a summery dress. We walked past an old guy sat on the bench, and I caught him staring. And as soon as I caught him staring, he looked away. And they always look back afterwards thinking that you've looked away. So I carried on staring at him, and he did that dog thing, you know, sat giving you side eye. And then I told Pip, I said, oh, there's another one staring. Immediately, she just shouted over at him, stop staring. His immediate reaction was to flick his arm up like that, telling her to just shut up and go away. The entitlement, it's unbelievable. Men feel they are entitled to do what they want around women, to behave how they want. And that is a really dark path, especially when we look at lesbians out, especially out as a couple. I know lots of lesbians, and I also know that many of them fear holding hands with their partner. My wife and I, we don't hold hands because I'm too scared to draw attention to the fact that we're together and anything happened to her. But that's what we have to do. We have to diminish ourselves in society just to prevent these incidents from happening.
I think, yeah, that's a great point. And something in, you know, with another hat on. So for those people who don't know, you know, I founded and chair Quinn's Pride at Harlequins Rugby Club. And one of the biggest things we do there, and you know, yeah, people know me, and I got all the hate and the death threats because I had the temerity to suggest that the banning of trans people was not maybe scientific, as had been suggested. But one of the biggest things we've done at the club, and one of the things I'm most proud of, is really, it is that mission to equalise the ability for LGBTQIA people just to exist and to do anything anyone else would do. So to your point there, am I confident at sporting events that a lesbian couple can hold hands and can embrace each other when we win the match and they can do that? I'm not confident. I'm definitely not confident that two gay men could embrace, could kiss. You know, I mean, Harlequins aren't winning anything at the moment, sadly. Still love you, Harlequins, but you know, it's not been a vintage season. But in those seasons where we have done really well, you know, we've won the championship. Could I imagine my gay friends embracing in the same way as I see my sort of cishet friends? Absolutely not yet. So we're really trying to break that down and work on that. And that's in a very small environment, effectively. You know, that's an environment of sort of 13,000, maybe a few more if we get to finals and things. But we're seeing that in the population, we're seeing that out and about, and that over-sexualization of women and queer women in particular, you know, and exactly when you talked about the couple on the bus, that's exactly the one that comes to my mind. There was an absolute overt sexualization of them. They were there for entertainment purposes. And again, as trans women, you know, we're denied our personhood, we're denied who we are, but there are plenty enough men who objectify us, who use pornography, which includes trans women, who are more than comfortable at seeing us in those situations, who are more than comfortable at sexually assaulting us in public. You know, nobody ever touched my backside until I transitioned. You know, in a crowded restaurant or a bar, you know, people wanted to push past me. They did what a usual person would do, which is you put your hands at the top of the person or the shoulder. But, you know, suddenly my bottom was the place people's hands went to. You know, we face into all of that, and yet it is denied as being misogynistic or transphobic or lesbophobic or biphobic or any of those things. So I think, you know, we've got a mission to really turn that on its head and make sure that we do report. And as I say, I've had it's sixth in person attacks on me since I came out 6 years ago. One a year virtually, but some years I don't have one, some years I have more than one. And the online stuff, and of all of those, I've only ever reported one of those to the police, because it was a particularly detailed, particularly violent doxing. It didn't go anywhere. But what stopped me from reporting everything else, it was that embarrassment, it was that wanting to get away, it was that fear of not being believed. In some cases, I've been spat on. I just wanted to get away and wash and clean myself. So there are methods that we can recommend to people for making sure that hate crime is reported and that we stand up to it. One of the ones that I know of is an app called Zoteria, which you can download for your phone. So that's Zoteria. And that allows you to report hate crimes to the police either with your name or anonymously as well, and make sure they are recorded, reported, and they are investigated. And that's definitely something that, you know, for those who are listening to the pod and thinking, well, what do we do? You should have that on your phone, and you don't have to be part of the community to have it there, because you can be a witness to hate crime, and people should be looking out for each other. What sort of view do you have on what people can do to sort of turn the tide of hatred against queer communities?
Quite a lot. I mean, I worked extensively with various police forces, sat on the Crown Prosecution Service's hate crime panel. There are a number of things that can be done. And I think, like you quite rightly said, a lot of people don't report because they fear being believed, having to out themselves, having to relive the trauma over and over. having to justify who they are and why they've experienced what they experienced. I can understand why people don't. I can also understand people don't understand transphobia. People, you know, as we said at the start, people don't really understand the experience that we've gone through, so they don't take it seriously. Zotero is a fantastic app. The one I always recommend is TrueVision, which is developed by, I think it's developed by and handled by Greater Manchester Police, but it serves all police forces. So Greater Manchester Police do the admin element, then it's pushed out to your local force or wherever the jurisdiction was. But it's online reporting for hate crime, and you can go to www.reportit.org.uk, I think it is, or just Google True Vision, True as in T-R-U. And on there, you can report specifically what happened, what type of hate crime, any witness evidence, anything, and it will go through to the police. And I know that especially a lot of trans women don't like picking up the phone and speaking to the police or speaking to anyone because they fear being outed, being misgendered because of how they sound. True Vision online is a fantastic way of doing it to get the ball rolling. If you want to out yourself and give lots of details about, you know, your background, your lived experience and how it led up to that, absolutely. But you don't have to, but at least it's there. And what I will say is there are also going to be times when the case doesn't go anywhere. There just isn't sufficient evidence. I've been involved in situations where, you know, there is evidence, but there's nothing physically to tie it to that particular incident. You know, I could have plucked that registration from anywhere. I could have looked at someone, a driver, and thought, I don't like the look of you, I'm going to accuse you. So sometimes, you know, it's just the way it is. If I had my phone out and I was filming and I could physically tie it to that incident, like, you know, how we use dash cams, fine. But it still gets recorded. And apps like TrueVision, Zotero, they do take all the statistics and that is fed into your local area. So when it comes to, you know, everyone dreads council tax going up and funding for the police and fire services and things like that. Well, that's what it goes towards. That they look at the area, they look at what's happening, and they make calls based on that. If there is a sudden huge spike in transphobic hate crime, they need to act upon it. But without the data to support us as a community saying you need to do more, they can't do more. So we need to kind of help them, and in doing so, help ourselves. You know, a number of conversations I've had with certain police forces, and they've said that they are more than capable of handling all the hate crime calls. They just don't get any. And if we were to just completely bombard them constantly, say this happened, I'm reporting it. Sooner or later, they have to do something about it. If they don't, we have the statistics and the number of calls and reports to back up that this is happening, but nothing is being done. The issue isn't with us.
Yeah, and that's despite an enormous spike in hate crime numbers for trans people, particularly broadly across the LGBTQ community. We also see that in faith groups and people of visible faith groups. We see it with people who are not white, effectively, and I fear, given some of the remarks that have been made this week publicly by our government, that we'll see an increase there. What we also saw, and I think this is really important, is we do see some playing around with the figures. So we did see a drop a couple of years ago, and that's because of this narrative of hate crime somehow being an infringement of free speech. And, and you know, this bizarre argument that you're entitled to say whatever you like, you know, how awful it is, how much it incites somebody else to act, and you know, what we might call stochastic terrorism, where you incite people who are less restrained and ready to act. And that's what we do see in public. So as a great example, the last 2 weeks, the sort of nonsense that we've seen floating around about access to spaces, that can seem like a very academic, you know, very sort of high level discussion for people at a political level. You know, and I know you, as I have spoken to some senior politicians and attempted to hold them to account on this basis. And for them, this is a matter of politics. It's a matter of cabinet, approach and unity of government. But the reality is that they're not the ones who are going to be standing in the street. They're standing outside the toilets, standing in the changing rooms, policing who comes past. I heard Pat McFadden on one of the sort of shows where one of the journalists, in an abrogation of their duty, was saying, well, you know, how's this going to work in practice? He said, oh, well, you know, we're not going to be policing bathrooms. No, Pat McFadden is not going to be policing bathrooms. Bridget Phillipson's not going to be policing bathrooms. Wes Streeting's not going to be policing bathrooms. Keir Starmer's not going to be policing bathrooms. But they've emboldened people mm-hmm. who are going to police bathrooms with violence. They're going to police bathrooms with threats. They're going to police yeah. bathrooms in a way which descends to hurt all of us. And they know that. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's important we call out hatred, even when it's not violent, even when yeah. people say, well, it's just free speech. Because actually, let's say, what are you calling for in your free speech? You know, of course, we all have the right to say things. But you also, you that comes with the responsibility of yeah. what you say has a repercussion. What you say may have a follow-on impact. And I think we've forgotten that. I think, you know, these sort of free speech absolutists have nothing to say when trans people were excluded, for example, from discussing the Supreme Court case or being involved in the Supreme Court case. They had nothing to say about that, but plenty to say about the fact that, you know, one of the most disgraceful transphobes finds themselves in court because they have escalated words. They have escalated them into violence. And of course, that is a live court case, so I won't discuss it yeah. much more.
But
to say that there was a pleasure in that escalation, and we're paying the price. And that's what Ida Hoblit's all about. It's about recognizing that and bringing it out of the shadows.
Yeah. And we have to absolutely call it out when it's freedom of speech only when it suits an individual, then it's no longer, it's not freedom of speech, because you've quite rightly said there are consequences, there's responsibility, and we have to look at what, it's not so much the words that come out of somebody's mouth, what can those words do? Who will those words embolden? What could it lead to? And if those words are then therefore classed as careless because they could lead to something, well, is it free speech or is it incitement? Is it somebody? Because let's face it, all those with power never get their hands dirty. They will always find ways you don't have to look at what's going on with the Republicans over in the US and, and how a certain rally turned into an insurrection, and how those involved in the insurrection were not politicians or of any sort of level. So we need to recognize, and you're absolutely right, we need to challenge the starting point of it. There's no point just tackling and reacting to being beaten up and calling that out. We need to start and go right back to the very words, the seeds, the very foundations, and say, this is where it began. There's a reason why the UK was once flying high in the ILGA rankings for Europe at first place consecutively for about seven or 8 years. And since 2015, we have dropped. And 10 years later, we've gone from first place to 22nd. And that will undoubtedly mean increased hate. And we need to understand, and I ask every single person who calls themselves an ally listening to this to go on the ILGA Europe site and look at all the different categories, look at all the different things that countries are rated upon, and see how the UK failed. And there is your starting point for how hate starts, because it comes from the over-policing of bathrooms, misinformation, disinformation in the press, politicians being careless with their words or being very strategic with their words. Mm-hmm. We need to start there, because otherwise, if we're only reacting to the beatings, being spat on, things like that, well, we're always going to live in fear, aren't we? Because, yes, we've tackled one specific issue and scenario, one particular moment in time, but we'll live in fear because those thoughts, those attitudes are still out there. We need to go right back and change those attitudes, and we all need to call it out.
Absolutely, couldn't agree more. And that whole point about living in fear, that is the purpose of those who oppose queer people, whether with words or with violence. Their intention is fear. Their intention is to remove us from being able to circulate, to be able to live our lives and just to go about our daily business. And you know, I think about some of the really great work that Mark Healy's done with Hate Crime Awareness Week, which happens later in the year. You know, reflecting on what we saw. I was in London when the Admiral Duncan was bombed. You know, when we went through that process of really understanding what was the purpose. What was the purpose of bombing the Admiral Duncan? What was the purpose of the bombs in Brixton? It was there to make people frightened. Yes, it was there to kill and to maim individuals on the day, but it was there to disrupt and say, don't come out because this might happen again. You know, I feel defiant and you know, I'm up and down at the moment. Somebody asked me how I was. I said, you know, some days I can conquer the world, some days you're getting out of bed is a struggle, and you know, today has been one of the latter. But I am defiant in general terms. I will not allow people to stop me from living my life. I'll not allow people to stop me from doing the things that I've always done, because I've always done them without harming anyone. I've never hurt anyone with what I do. And I don't know any trans people who have, you know, and actually we just don't have the evidence that queer people are hurting other people by doing the same things everyone else does. So we shouldn't be frightened. We must be aware. We must be vigilant. We've got to try not to be hypervigilant, because that's not helpful. That has similar outcomes to PTSD in terms of mental well-being. But it's incumbent on us as a queer community to make sure we live. You know, we've got to live because we've got to be visible, because we've got to be there for those younger people who are coming behind us. But it's our, you know, our allies who call themselves allies, who, you know, I've had people reach out to me saying how horrified they are. I'm standing with you. I'm behind you. I don't want you standing behind me. You should be standing in front of me, shielding me from some of the blows. Yeah. I want allies out there close enough to get hit by the rocks that are being thrown at us. Because if they're not close enough, they're not close enough. That's what we need from allies now. We need a few of you to stand up and disobey and to disrupt attempts to stop LGBTQIA people from living their lives. That's the only way this is going to work. That's the only way any social justice campaign has ever worked, is when people from the majority, when people from the oppressing group put themselves in that place. And it shouldn't be that way. And there's part of me that gets really angry that it's that way, that only we're only listened to when some cis people get involved or some straight people get involved. But that's the reality of it. And you know, we recognize that in the American civil rights movement, that, you know, some very prominent white people had to get involved and get arrested and get killed, you know, as we saw in Alabama. You know, they don't, it's not about them, but they had to be involved because that jolted a few people out of their complacency. And that's what we need on Ida Hoblit and every day. Is that active allyship, that activity to disrupt, to disobey. You know, I think civil disobedience is a moral imperative when something is unjust. And that's really, I guess I'm kind of running out of things to say about, you know, getting beaten up and spat on and abused. That's what we've got to do as we move forward, because that's the only way we stop this in its tracks. And and you're right, everyone should get on the IGLA website, read those stats. We've gone yellow for the first time, so it's green, amber, red, you know, green, yellow, amber, red. We've gone yellow for the first time. We were a very light, you know, sickly shade of green until this year. We're now below 50% in the marking scheme for where we're at, and it's getting worse.
We're heading down the same path as Georgia and Hungary.
I mean, it was released this morning. It's now 10 past one. I haven't seen any response from our equalities minister. I haven't seen any response, you know, from the government to that report. I am fully expecting them to start talking about how it's more a factor that other countries are doing better, and that is not the case. We are in some ways leading the way and dragging other countries down. You know, there are some bright spots in there. Malta, Spain, Iceland, you know, still standing firm. Germany, improvements in Germany, but more than wiped out by the legitimacy that what we're doing here in the UK and in the US is giving to people to be appalling in other parts of Europe. And that's why when people talk about leaving the country, and I do get very annoyed, I have to say, to some of our community who sort of talk, you know, very sort of glibly about, oh, it's time to leave the country, it's time to escape. Not everyone can.
Mm-hmm.
Not everyone has the means to do that. Not everyone has the legal ability to do that. Not everyone wants to do that. And I would say nobody should have to do that. Because once you move somewhere else, who's to say that the hate doesn't move there? Who's to say the hate doesn't, you know, follow around Europe? And yeah, I've been saying that as an Irish citizen myself, to some of my Irish friends, they're seeing it already. They're seeing that bleed over because people feel the war is won in the UK. They feel that hate, their hatred is winning. They're looking for their next target. They're looking for the next place they can rally to. So we have to stand firm across every line. And again, on Ida Hoblit, let's not talk about retreat. Let's not talk about giving up ground. It stops here, not one step further back. And that's all I'm going to say on things. And I'll leave you with the last word today, Eva.
I mean, I completely, pun intended, echo all of that. I think there are those who, I can understand why they want to flee the UK, but in doing so, you're simply letting hate win. And I'm sure people remember recently when Instagram or Meta announced that they would not be policing transphobic comments. And there was a mass exodus from Meta platforms. Well, again, if you leave, great for you. But what about everyone else who can't leave? What about those who use it for business? Again, you're letting hate win by just simply allowing Meta to become Twitter. And let's face it, we all know what happened there with Twitter. So standing firm is absolutely the way to go. And I would say to allies, stand firm and do not be afraid to make enemies in the name of doing the right thing. You know, because if someone said that about you and your family, you wouldn't like it. But you're happy to stand by and just keep the peace and just be in a really awkward situation for a bit because someone made it about a trans person or a lesbian or a, you know, bisexual. If you're not willing to, then you can't use the title of ally. You can't call yourself an ally. You need to be stood in front of us right now saying to the world, these are my people too, I will protect them, and I'm not afraid of losing friends, family or sleep over those who don't agree with me. We need that active step up. And I would also say to the more militant members of our LGBTQ plus community, we really need unity right now because we are driving each other away from the country, the community, from events, from places, because everyone seems to have this idea of how to fix things. And the fact is, there is no one faction that can fix this. We've gone down the road of hate for so long now. It's not just the case of one group's going to, you know, set up parliamentary meetings and convince the politicians. That's never going to happen now. We need unity. We need unity with our allies, and we need to stand firm. And those with really militant attitudes, I would say, please try and relax them, because it does put off our allies when they see how really extreme sort of views. And I know where those extreme views come from. It comes from trauma and desperation and anger, frustration. But we need to channel that into constructive action, because we need to be setting the standard on how to stand firm. And if we're losing it, allies aren't going to want to stand firm with us, because it's not just every day that we live through this. Now, if we don't stand firm, everyone in the future the next generation and the generation after them will also face this. Mm-hmm. We're condemning them to a life of misery. So let's end it here. Let's all stand firm and let's stand together.
Yeah, absolutely. It's time to stop. No more generational trauma.
Mm.
Well, that was a grim old session, I have to say. Not our usual humorous one. And I can't even think of a sort of humorous way out. So I promise all of you, dear listeners, that next time me and Eva get together, we will be more lighthearted.
Yeah.
We will find some topic to talk absolute bizarre weirdness about. And frankly, if you've got some ideas about that, why not write in and tell us what you want to talk about? And
absolutely,
you know, we'll busk on it for 45 minutes. But
yeah, if you want to write in about pineapple on pizza, does it belong there? You know, I'm open to suggestions and opinions on that. So
we've got strong views on pineapple on pizza, or pineapple in hairstyling as another option. Thank you, Eva. Difficult times, but always good to spend some time with you talking on these things. And I won't say happy Ida Hoblet to everyone. I will say, let's mark Ida Hoblet. Let's make a difference this year, and let's make sure that people in future years say, what on earth was that all about?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks, everyone.